I'm your host, Juliet, and I'm here with my co-host, Teresa.
Hi.
And you're listening to Mind the Gap. Mind the Gap is a podcast dedicated to discovering the minds behind health, rehabilitation, and neuroscience researchers. So sit back, relax, and please, mind the gap. Today we are here with Hudson from Hudson's Hot Takes.
Hello.
Hudson, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh boy, sure. I was born in Vancouver, opposite coast, and raised just outside in the suburbs because my parents decided that raising a family in a city was a horrible idea. And boy, were they right. That city stinks. So I moved to the suburbs where I grew up. You know, running down mountains, falling off cliffs, that sort of thing. And playing lacrosse, which I miss quite a bit. But years later, I went to university at the University of British Columbia, where I did my undergrad in psychology. And I am now apparently known for my hot takes.
Yes, I would say that's quite true. A lot of people have been giving raving reviews about your hot takes, you know, some more positive than others because they tend to disagree with some things that you say. So we'll get into that more a little bit later. But I liked the storyline. I think a lot of times we ask people to tell us a little bit about themselves and they're like, I don't know anything about myself.
That's so true. Those are like the worst 3 seconds to hear afterwards. Someone's like, tell me about yourself. And you're just like, oh no, I don't know. My name's Teresa. That's all I've got.
I felt like a first date. Immediately
you're my mind goes blank. And I was almost born Monday, September 11th.
Oh no, if I have to be asked again what time and location I'm born at, oh my goodness, what rotation was the earth in?
Yeah, I always think back to this time where I was like in the airport and a like police officer, it wasn't a police officer, but I thought it was a police officer, it was just a security officer, said like, how old are you? And immediately I forgot. I was like, I don't know, my birthday was recently, I don't know how. And he's like, you don't know how old you are? And I was like, I can't remember. Anyways, that's kind of how I think people feel when we ask them to tell us about themselves. It's like suddenly they forget everything that they've ever done. So
yeah, I did miss out some stuff. Yeah. I didn't do those 3 things, but there's more, but we'll breeze past that for now.
Yeah, but speaking of first date questions, our new segment is to ask you first date questions to get to know you better. And for people who don't know, I got my original list of first date questions from Hudson, but I chose 2 different ones today, so you're not asked questions you already know.
Great, thank you. Everyone's going to think I'm a serial dater now.
Yeah. I didn't really want to out
you. It's actually your full-time job.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't really want to out you for that, but like, to be honest, it's so smart to keep a first dates question list in on your phone, because otherwise you end up with, tell me about yourself.
Oh man, now the illusion's gone. I hope no one that I go on a date with listens to this part.
Yeah, it's not the same Hudson. Anyways, yeah,
different Hudson.
Different Hudson. So my first question is, if you could travel back in time to experience 3 historical events, which ones would they be?
Can I observe events from a safe space, kind of as if I'm a third yes. person? Okay, so yeah, kind of like an immortal Doctor Who sort of thing.
Yeah, so you're not going to actually like be able to, I guess, like you're not going to be able to shake Abraham Lincoln's hand. You're kind of just an observer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then first would be the Big Bang, because I think that would be pretty cool to see.
Yes.
The second would probably be shortly after the fall of Rome, just to see basically thousands of years of history just turn back into sticks and stones sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think Oh, it sounds like I just love destruction. But the third would be the burning of the Library of Alexandria. But a couple hours before, because I would like to peruse it beforehand and see, you know, what do they have in the collection, right? Like, is there Jesus's diary? Oh, man. I don't know if this is before Jesus, maybe.
You don't need to be historically accurate. It's
okay.
Fine.
Yeah. All right. Okay. But that's the third that I would like to see. Just, sorry, not the burning of it.
Just like the just before
pre-burn, right before burning. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. That makes sense. Those are good. I think I would want to see something related to Neanderthals.
Yeah, I was going to say dinosaurs, but I feel like Jurassic Park is I pretend that I'm there,
Yeah, or what's the – there's one really popular dinosaur museum in Alberta.
Oh, the La Brea Tar Pits? Is that – no, that's in California. Drumheller.
Yes, Drumheller. Yeah. I'm glad that you know it because I was like I feel like I'm not even an Albertan at this point for forgetting that.
Oh, man, and I remember – oh, man, uh-oh. Uh-oh, my Vancouver card is going to get revoked.
Yeah, hopefully no one's listening from Vancouver. It's not the same Hudson.
So, Hudson, we were wondering, do you have any claims to fame?
Huh. I wouldn't necessarily call it a claim to fame, but I was, from the ages of 17 to 21, a background actor in Vancouver, and my first role was playing a photo double, which isn't really a role, but it's slightly above a background role, just general background, because I'm supposed to be playing some sort of named character. And this was teenaged George Clooney as he leaves Disney's Tomorrowland. And I remember this was my first time on a movie set and I'm walking to hair and makeup. I have no idea what's going on. And my mom's with me because I was a minor and it was my first day on set. So she had to walk me basically to set and then she could leave. But I remember going to hair and makeup and walking behind this guy in front of us. And she steps into the trailer to my right and I go into the one to the left and I say to my mom, wow, that guy really looked like George Clooney. And the AD, like the assistant director leading me to hair and makeup, turns around and says, that was George Clooney.
Oh my gosh.
So I didn't really meet him, but we made eye contact.
That's meeting.
Yeah. Meeting of the souls.
Yes.
But I guess that's my pitiful claim to fame. Yeah, and then the screen time is a total of a whopping like 7 seconds, but it was
what
my most memorable.
That?
Sorry, that's Disney's Tomorrowland.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, and for people who have seen it, I don't play the child. That's not the child. George Clooney is an actual actor. I have a very short scene where I'm basically, spoiler alert, George Clooney is banished from Tomorrowland, and all I do is walk out of Tomorrowland and walk away. That's it.
So do they hire you to do that because the child actor isn't available or like what?
So in this particular circumstance, I guess the child actor wasn't old enough. He was a child. So it was supposed to be time had passed. George Clooney is now older. And I think I was supposed to be 17-ish. So at the time I was that age and he just got banished from Tomorrowland, like the actual place in the movie. So that's it's him leaving as an older, I guess, adolescent. Yeah.
That is really cool, though.
That
I think
really cool.
I think if that were me, I would be like, I would definitely be like, I'm famous.
Yeah.
But I feel like my trailer was next to Clooney's.
Yeah, it reminds me of like Monsters, Inc. I don't know if you guys remember like, what's his name? Wazowski.
Mike Wazowski.
He like gets to be on like the cover of like a magazine or he gets to be in like a trailer, but like his face is covered in like both of those things.
Yeah, that's basically my experience. Yeah. It's like both, not famous at all, but in movies.
Yeah, yeah. That's so cool though. I was also thinking like claims to fame could also be some sort of weird talent that you have or something that, you know, I don't know. I mean, you're. It's kind of.
Do you
hard
have a
to
talent you can
that,
do?
My old party trick was solving a Rubik's cube. I didn't bring one with me. It was whenever I saw one, would you try to impress people.
Yeah.
And I guess it's not really a weird talent. It's weird that I took the time to learn how to do it, I suppose. But yeah.
Honestly, mm-hmm. I've definitely been impressed by a Rubik's cube-er.
Well, I'm glad we continue to impress.
Yeah, it's. I think that's a good claim to fame.
Thank you.
So, as mentioned before, you are responsible for the Hudson's Hot Takes. So we have a few questions regarding them, starting with, how do you even come up with them? Are these like hot takes that you just like strongly feel and you like write down and you're just like, I hope somebody agrees with me? Or
yeah, so,
or do people like come to you and tell you something you're like, no,
I disagree,
it's all
absolutely not.
It's I guess a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. It's all of that, really, if it comes into my mind. Or some of them I do feel on a personal level. For instance, the one about ketchup. And it's not, it's all a hyperbole, right? Like, yeah. I don't hate ketchup. I just prefer other things. I prefer mustard, prefer relish. But, you know, if I'm at a restaurant and the burger comes with ketchup, I'm not going to ask them to not put ketchup on it.
Yeah. Mm.
So it's, I kind of run with it. And I aim for a point where I think that 50%, give or take, are going to agree or disagree with me. I want it split right down the middle. So not all of the hot takes I actually hold as a personal opinion. You know, the one about pets not being family. That, yeah. So,
I didn't hear that one.
So the argument, that's the argument that I took, but I don't believe that,
okay.
Right? Like,
I was going to say, soulless.
My mom has cats, one of which is a boy, and that is the favorite boy of the family, for sure. It's her favorite son. as much as she would be, no, of course you're, no, God, that cat is a king in that house. It's impressive. He has literally the most expensive cat food, I think, on the face of the earth. But, you know, he's well-loved, and he's my brother.
He's your brother.
So,
yeah.
I don't hold all of them as personal beliefs. And then it's, if someone tells me something and I just think it's a wild take, I kind of co-opt it and then I'll pass it on.
Yeah.
Like, not all of them are my ideas. Most of them are. The vast majority are. And then I just sit down once I have a general idea and try and flesh it out. Some of them are better than others. Some are, you know, hard to do because of the form factor. I don't want to keep them too long or too short. And I want to not necessarily justify them, but not just make a claim and leave it at that, right?
Yeah.
Like ketchup sucks.
Yeah. Like the pets and family one, honestly, by the end of it, I was like, all right, I can see where you are coming from. Because Teresa, at some point in it, he talks about how, you know, You can remind me exactly what you said, Hudson, but it's something about, like, they're not as annoying as kids can be, basically. And by the end, it ends up with a positive spin for the pets, but maybe a semi-negative for the kids.
So they're, like, above the family.
Yeah.
Yes.
The minors in the family.
I think... I can't remember what I said, to be honest.
It's like, I guess it's not a huge comparison of like who's better than the other. Mm-hmm. It's more just like there are negatives to having kids, like not negatives to stop you from having kids, but negatives in terms of like they're expensive and they're messy and they're loud and like stuff like that, which you get to a lesser degree with pets. So it ends up being like a positive spin for the pets, which... Yeah, but, you know, I guess I still think of them as family. I am going to be like your mom in the future.
Yeah, fair enough. I hope to be, too. You can tell none of us have kids.
Yeah, we speak highly of them.
Yeah. Other than that, I don't know. I just, to be honest, most of the time, I make them minutes before I come in to record them because Juliet asked me to, and I'm sometimes horrible at remembering things like that. So,
well, it's, that's even better. It's more authentic, right? Yeah, it's just basically live.
Yeah, more or less, yeah. Well, I would love to record some live. That would be, but I think those would be a little too hot. Maybe I don't want any flaming hot.
I'll start a new segment. Yeah. Flaming hot
takes. Skip over this part if you're going to be offended.
Oh boy.
Viewer discretion advised.
We get a 14A label on this.
If you don't like pets not being family, you're not going to like the flaming hot takes.
Oh, yeah, no, not at all.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to jeopardize on that. You bet I am. And then I'm going to regret it because I'm going to waste your time and be like,
can't use that.
Can't use that one. So sorry.
So which hot take would you say is your favorite of the ones that we've heard, I guess?
Oh, man.
I don't know if you need a recap of
Do you have a recap of them? So the ones that come to mind for me were the ketchup one, because I truly feel that it is an overrated condiment, and I'll stand behind that.
Yeah.
The second one, because I don't know if you left it in the podcast, but the one where I talked about the best way to listen to to read a book is to listen to the audiobook.
Oh,
and
yes.
Then the second I stopped recording it, you were like, I don't like that. So that one I really liked, because I knew that that would really upset people who are avid readers.
Yeah, I'm not going
to lie. Then there would be a 50-50 split,
exactly.
I feel like.
And so, it's going to make it into a podcast. It hasn't yet. So listeners, forward to that one.
Oh, maybe a little.
Maybe I'll add it to the end of this one. Wow. We'll see.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah.
What other ones? I think the pet one. Basically, whoever has come back to me and said that they heard it and tell me that they don't agree with it.
Yeah.
Those are my favorite ones, because that's the point.
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite one was the one about cereal. That one I thought was so funny. And that's at the end of the podcast with Kyle in it. And I just think it's so funny because it's you set it up so that you think you're going to say, like, if you put milk in before your cereal, then you're nuts, you put cereal in first, and then you end off with like, no, milk does not go with cereal. It's just so funny. I just really like that one.
That one was kind of crazy to write, because I love cereal.
And you love it dry though.
No.
Oh.
Okay.
That was a different Hudson.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a Hudson that's, from
it's not this
BC.
Hudson. Yeah, that's the one from Vancouver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do. It's something that I also do is I do have dry cereal as a snack.
Yeah, I've been into that recently.
Mm-hmm. Because of the hot take, or
maybe I started feeling a bit ashamed to put milk in.
I'm just kidding.
I never really ate it for breakfast, but I definitely strategically put that one into Kyle's episode, because he eats a bowl of cereal every morning for breakfast.
It's pretty ironic, because I have basically granola cluster, almost, I guess. Not necessarily cereal, but it's like protein, like granola. And Greek yogurt, which is effectively just bad milk.
Yeah. It's milk that's been there for a little too long.
Yeah, curdled milk.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I love the end of that where it's like, grow up. Eat a bowl of cereal. Or no, eat a bowl of porridge or whatever, oatmeal.
Yeah. Yeah. Clearly I need to grow up. So.
Yeah. Although I think in that you actually suggest like yogurt and granola.
Oh, do I? Yeah. Good. I'm covering all my bases.
Yeah.
Then.
You cover
good job,
it as
past
a grown up. But it's so funny actually when you think about it that we like look down on people who eat cereal for breakfast as if it's unhealthy, and then we continue to eat the same thing in different
for yeah. It really is just a slight step above like Choco Puffs or whatever.
That's funny though. They are definitely a good source of entertainment. I like being the one to hear them first, but you get to watch my live reaction to them, so it's a bit intimidating.
I think my favorite ever moment of it was the first time I walked in and just sat down, and Haley was still in the room, but she was leaving. And I said, this wasn't recorded, I don't think. Maybe it was, but honor students aren't real people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And she just glares at me before
I'm like, what?
Yeah, I still have that saved. Maybe I'll throw it into this one.
Oh, man, that was, yeah. For the record, I don't believe that. It was for a cheap haha, and I think I got it.
Yeah.
I
did want to add it into Ernest's episode, but it just seemed like so out of pocket.
Oh,
that,
man.
I should have done it, honestly. But anyways, beyond Hudson's hot takes, you, as you mentioned, did your undergrad at UBC, and you're now here at Dowell doing your master's degree. So we'll just kind of dive right into questions related to research. Mm-hmm. So how did you get involved with the LBRF lab?
So do you want the abridged version or the full story?
Give us
go right into it.
The full story?
Yeah.
All right. It unironically starts in summer 2020, where I had just finishing up my undergrad at UBC during this little thing called the COVID-19 pandemic.
Oh, what's that?
Allegedly a little thing.
Allegedly a little thing, yeah. But I was finishing up everything online and was pretty disillusioned with school at that point, because like everyone else, I was basically writing all of my finals on a beach or something along the lines like that. Just outrageous scenarios where you're either in your childhood bedroom or outside on the deck writing a final, and it just felt so dystopian to me. But nonetheless, all of the job prospects that I had lined up for after graduating and the summer that I would, my last summer semester, went out the wayside when we first went into lockdown. No research labs were recruiting anymore. Most weren't even performing any research. So I didn't have anything lined up for after graduating, not for lack of trying. And I have family and family friends out here. And one of my old high school friends who became my roommate in Halifax was telling me that they were moving from Vancouver to Halifax the next week. And I said, do you have room in the car?
Oh my God.
And they said, yeah, we do. So my parents were on vacation.
No.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I call them and I say, hey, I'm moving to Halifax next week. When are you guys home? I want to say goodbye. And they have so many questions, rightfully so. But I explained, like, you know, it's me, my friend Evan, and my other friend Kyle. And you know, there's all of our job prospects had fallen through. All of us were in the same boat, either just finishing or finished undergrad in 2020 with nothing going on afterwards. And we wanted a little bit of an adventure. And, you know, there's the maritime bubble. We all had some form of family out there. So it just made sense to do. And after explaining that to my parents, they were like, well, we'll see you for a day before you leave. That's when they returned and they helped me pack. And then the next morning, I got in a car and three grown men drove from Vancouver to Halifax almost nonstop.
Wow.
In a Mazda 3.
Nice.
So it was a pretty cramped
with
all of our stuff. Yeah.
That's unreal.
Yeah. I would not recommend that ever. We went from Vancouver to Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario without stopping, and dear God almighty, I didn't want to be in a car ever again after that. But back to the question of how did I get involved with the lab. So in Halifax, right, looking for a job, find a job. And then I had been interested in grad school, but not really at UBC. And it's not really a knock to UBC, but I was kind of disillusioned and disenfranchised with the school at that point. I didn't necessarily think that their handling of COVID was good at the time. They were slow to react, not really accommodating. It fell on the profs, which I didn't think was fair, when it should have been an administrative level thing. Mm-hmm. But who am I to say? Maybe I don't know enough information, whatever. Regardless.
And these are all just Hudson's own personal opinions.
Yes,
I was
sorry.
Going to say Hudson's hot
this
take.
This is all from anecdotal
as you are allowed to have your opinions.
Yes. And quite frankly, all of my classes went seamlessly. Mm. I just felt that, you know, it was...
the optics.
Yeah, the optics. Yeah. And you know what? It was so insane from the time that it happened that... when COVID happened, that like there's no one to point blame at, right? Like it was a crazy time for everyone. But regardless, I thought that with moving across the country, I didn't really want to apply to grad school back west because I wanted an adventure, I guess. And I applied for some programs out here and in Toronto. And it wasn't until I was talking to one of my new friends out here, Rachel, that she brought my attention to Sean and the lab, because I was interested in neuro and psych. And then she said, well, have you heard about this program in this lab? And I had back out at UBC, which is pretty funny, but I'd never looked into further where they were located, and they were located in Halifax. So I just reached out to Sean. We had a meeting and he agreed to help me apply to the program, and bada bing, bada boom.
Now you're here.
Here I am. And boy, that was a great decision. It's been a blast so far. I mean, a couple more months left. Hopefully it doesn't turn into not being a blast, but it's been great. I'm very happy with the decision that I made to pursue not only grad school, but to do it in the lab and with Sean as my supervisor.
Yeah, you struck gold.
I did. Yeah. And come to find out that, allegedly, my own personal opinion, this is not the case with a lot of other grad students.
Yeah.
Where, you know, either supervisors are extremely busy or just kind
not
of...
not involved.
Yeah, go AWOL, MIA, just not present. And the students are kind of left... to completely flounder, which has not been the case at all with Sean. He's, as we all know, it's insane the amount of work that he could do and people and tasks that he could take on. It really is. It's like watching a wizard work.
I know. And then he just very casually is like, yeah, I'm going on vacation. Like, he's like, yeah, you do you. You take time off. Yeah,
please. We need you in tip-top shape for when you come back.
This boat from sinking.
Yeah. That's
a
really interesting story, though. I didn't
know that.
Yeah, I mean, like, I knew bits and parts of it because I've been talking about getting my Kia Soul from Victoria to Halifax. You did tell me about your road trip that you did, but I didn't. I don't think I realized that you moved to Halifax before deciding to be in the lab. But yeah. I think that's really cool. I feel like it's meant to be that you're in the lab. If that's the case,
yeah. I was here for a full year before joining the lab, and it was that was like the first time I would consider being out of the house as like a in quotes adult, because it wasn't school. I was just working, so it was, and in a new city, which was really fun. It was just fun to do that. Take that, I like to call forced gap year. But yeah very happy with the decision overall and the lab in general.
So can you tell us a little bit about what you're currently involved in the lab in regards to your research?
Well, in the lab, I am, like Juliet, doing a master's in rehab research. So I'm in my second year, which entails data collection. So if anyone would like to participate in a research study, shameless plug, please check out our website and sign up to my study. It's my name's Hudson Barr.
But not the Hudson that you...
Yes, yeah, allegedly a different Hudson.
Yeah.
or sign up to that Hudson study, and that would help some Hudson greatly, question mark.
And if you want to participate, stop listening to the podcast.
Yeah,
now.
Go sign up.
Go to bolab.ca and sign up.
Is it .ca or .com?
I think it's .ca.
It's .ca.
Yeah.
Am I?
I'm just gonna verify this because
we're having a Mandela effect moment.
Bolab. I'm pretty sure it's .com.
Really?
Oh, we're horrible.
Oh, wow. Okay. Uh-oh. Correction.
Yeah. We can edit this out, right?
Yeah, bolab.com.
So, yeah, go to
bolab.com. What if you type in .ca, though?
Oh.
Would it take
Oh, maybe
you?
It portals you?
Yeah.
This is, we need to know.
Let's see. bolab.ca.
Nope.
Oh, nothing. We should take the domain from Sean and tell him and then sell it to him for a higher price.
Yeah. That's a good idea. So, yeah, anyways, go to bolab.com. And stop listening to this podcast.
Do Hudson study, then come back to where you stopped and continue listening.
Exactly. So after you've participated in my study, after that, then it's just thesis writing. And the thesis and the study overall is on motor learning through imagery. In particular, I'm looking at the effect of task nature on cortical spinal excitability.
So what tasks are they doing?
Right. So there's a more perceptual, I'm doing air quotes, they can't see, perceptual task, which is basically a finger tapping task. All you're doing is tapping or imagining to tap a keyboard in response to an auditory cue, which is a number. So for instance, when you hear one, you will hit the one key with your index finger, two with your middle, three with your ring, and four with your pinky. And then there's another task that we're calling, again in air quotes, the motoric task, which is a trajectory tracing task, trace lab for those in the lab. And we're pitting those head to head against each other in my study in terms of their effect on cortical spinal excitability when these tasks are performed using imagery, with a kind of underlying assumption, or the hypothesis being that the motoric task will lead to a greater change in cortical spinal excitability relative to its baseline than the perceptual task. Mm. And the kind of motivation for the study more generally is that a lot of motor imagery research, in particular the research involving TMS in imagery, tends to use these finger tapping tasks as a metric for motor learning and drawing inferences to the nature of motor imagery and its mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of trying to challenge that in a way that shows, one, it could be the task's influence, such as how motoric is a finger tapping task actually, mm-hmm. right? To draw inferences about motor learning through imagery when you're pressing a key on a keyboard, it just seems a little fishy. Not fishy, sorry, but like it's certainly a motoric task.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about motor learning through the aspect of, let's say, you know, neuro rehab, that's a big thing. Or just learning a novel skill, like throwing a baseball or practicing for a sport, and comparing that to a finger tapping task and drawing inferences and making assumptions
about what you can motor imagery does.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, it really is just testing that. And you know what? Very well, I haven't taken a peek under the hood at any of the data yet, but there could be no effect, and that's totally fine. It's just something that's never been done, and Sean and I thought it was worth investigating. Mm-hmm. So pretty exciting. Definitely some challenges in terms of recruitment, which I think it's just the logistics of recruiting for a TMS study. Teresa, I'm sure you're aware of this, which I was, but not directly, right? Like watching other people recruit for the study, it was, you know, you're like, oh, like that will definitely be a challenge, but you don't really realize how big of a challenge it is until you're the one doing it.
Yeah.
It is a lot of fun to do, though, I will say. So it's definitely rewarding.
Yeah, your research is really interesting. It's very relevant. I think the project that I want to do, back in September, there was like a running joke going around about how I wanted to buy a robot in the lab.
Yeah.
And the whole idea behind that was what I want to focus my research on is how we can adapt to new environments with motor imagery. And what I wanted the robot for is there's these robots that are really, really expensive, but they basically apply force to your hand and you need to adapt your pointing movement. So if you're pointing straight ahead and they push your arm out of the way, then you need to adapt your movement so that you don't get pushed by the robot.
Oh.
Yeah. So that was like the...
It's a very specific robot.
It's used a lot in like stroke recovery. It's which is why it's really expensive, because like they don't just program it to do a simple reach and point task. Like there's a lot of different things.
Could we not use another lab's robot? Isn't there the rehabilitation clinic right next to the lab?
Well, I don't think that they have this specific robot in Halifax. Like, I think we looked a little bit, but one of the things that I came across, so my new idea for my thesis is basically to have prism goggles. So you're, instead of having a force on your body, your vision of your environment changes. Hmm. So everything gets shifted to the right by 15 degrees. So anyways, as I was reading through papers on different paradigms, different methodology for adaptation, I found a lot of things that said that while force field adaptation, which would be using the robot, seems to have like a lot of cool findings, a lot of those findings are not necessarily motor learning, but it's just learning to adapt to the robot, not necessarily to any new environment, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's like one of the major drawbacks of force field adaptation research is like the fact it's kind of similar to your issue that you're trying to address, is like, is the tasks that we're doing for motor imagery studies, are they truly motoric? Is similar, it's like, are we actually adapting, or are we just kind of like interacting with a robot?
Totally. It really is, it's almost like a validity not it might not even be an issue. In your case, it seems like it is an issue, but it
was kind of like, I'd need to read the paper again to see like how big the effects are, but it's generally a big issue in science, in that our like what we are studying in a lab setting, is it does it translate to the real world? So I would assume, I could be wrong, but I'd assume your study, say you find that there is one task that's more motoric than the other, I feel like what comes from that is maybe trying to do motor imagery research in not a lab setting, question mark. Anyways, it's just an interesting thought in general. I think all of the theoretical work that we do on motor imagery is still valuable, even if there isn't necessarily, like, even with lab limitations, because we're still understanding processes that are occurring in the mind as we do them, especially with tools like the TMS that allows us to inhibit or facilitate certain brain regions. So it's still really important, but it is like, there's always going to be a downside to anyone's research, and one in behavioral neuroscience is that we're in a lab setting.
I think that is unavoidable to an extent, but it is important, and this extends beyond our own research, but to other researchers as well, that, you know, you're making sure that the measurement tool or paradigm, scale, what have you, is actually appropriate, right? Like, you wouldn't measure someone's weight with a ruler. Yeah. It just doesn't make sense to do.
Yeah, but, which is why you need to question, like, are the tasks we're doing for motor imagery, are they the best tasks to use?
Especially if you're trying to draw inferences about neural processes and things along those lines.
Yeah, and like, I guess if your results show similar cortical excitability, then basically it's fine. Like, it's not a bad result, because it's saying, I'm making inferences right now, but if we assume that the drawing task is more motoric than the number pointing task, and they show the same levels of corticospinal excitability, in my head that means maybe they're both equally motoric.
Sure. But, you know, that's something that
I mean, more research would need to be done. Yeah, obviously, absolutely. But,
and really, the, for instance, even validating the conceptualization of either task as perceptual or motoric, like, that that's just new and something that is kind of just taken it a little bit more than face validity. There's some data to show that the tasks are preferencing, one's preferencing perceptual or cognitive learning more than the other. So that's kind of what inspired this sort of spectrum that we came up with that we're loosely calling a perceptual motor spectrum. But that alone would, you know, it is a novel area for motor imagery research, which is why we chose it. And it does open up the door to a lot more research to be done regarding different attributes of tasks for motor learning via imagery or physical practice, what have you.
That is cool.
Yeah, super exciting. And it's been a blast so far.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I was fine. That's like, I don't know. I was talking to Hudson and Teresa today about how I'm trying to write my proposal. And it's like, I find just talking about it casually to be so much more enjoyable than writing the actual thing. Because I sit there like, motor learning is. Yeah. yada, yada, yada. But like, just having you and all the other students in our lab come on the podcast and like listening to you guys talk about your research, I'm like already inspired again. It's like I can get so caught up in the nitty gritty of like the actual like day to day tasks as like a master's process, students. Yeah. But then when you like look big picture at all the research that we're doing and all of them together, you're like, we're doing science over here. This is really cool.
Yeah.
This is worth the trip from Vancouver to Halifax for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
And so that brings me to my next question, which is, what is the overall impact of the research that you do? We kind of touched on it a little bit with the making sure we're measuring the same thing, but going beyond like the theoretical part of your research, like what's the impact in the real world?
My research out of Sean's?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I forgot that you do more than just Sean's research. We can get
to that. Oh, I was like, who else? Who are you doing a master's with?
For the research out of the lab, it would certainly be the neuro rehab angle. At least that's, I'm sure there's more applications, but that's just the one that I is saying I'm most interested in. Is that
I think as a lab, that's kind of because
it's all about learning new skills, right?
And we're in the physio school, of course we're gonna and be you're more doing focused on rehab,
a rehab research based yes
I'm biased
so you are biased but yeah it's always, sometimes it can be hard as students to see the link between what we're actually doing and like the real world impact. And I do think that just adding to our current understanding of theoretical knowledge on a topic is enough. But you know, sometimes grant applications want more.
In that case, then there is just the general learning aspect of it, where relearning a skill and learning a skill, they're both learning. I'm sure some other neuroscientist would be absolutely furious that I just said that. But when push comes, you know, it could have uses for occupational training, that sort of stuff as well. So I do think that even though it's basic research, and I don't know what, I've been listening to other podcasts, namely the Andrew Huberman one. Sorry, Juliet, I do branch out. But
it's okay. I want you to.
there's like a, it's kind of like frowned upon that some things are just basic science, which to me just doesn't, like applied science comes from basic science.
Yeah.
So the work we're doing now is I'm doing basic science with the hopes that one day it can become applied science. Yeah. And it certainly seems to be going in that direction.
Yeah,
but definitely. It's super weird that,
that can be another hot take.
Well, it's not too hot, though.
But I agree with you. But it's really relevant in my brother's field of research because he does computer science research, but he also has a degree in math. And one of the biggest things is like when you're applying for scholarships and everything and people are asking you like, why are you studying the pigeon in a hole concept in math? What relevance does this have in the real world? They basically always have to come up with an answer of like, you know, this will be important sometime. Yeah. You know, maybe not right now, but
one day.
One day we're going to need this. And it's true. There should be an emphasis on doing research for the sake of research, because we don't know everything and we need to learn more about things, which is why we have funding agencies like NSERC.
Right. So. No, it's true. I mean, what was it? The MRI, right? I don't want to be reductive, but some very smart people playing around with hydrogen atoms, and boom, you have the most advanced medical piece of equipment in the world. Without that, right, you don't get these fancy pieces of machinery that can see your brain
and be applied.
And not to get too far off topic, but I was chatting about my research with my brother recently, because he listened to the episode with Sean, and he was like, oh yeah, I was so impressed with my brother Felix's response, because he didn't know what I did for research. And as we were talking about it, it turns out that our research is very similar, because while he's doing AI stuff on autonomous driving and I'm doing motor learning in motor imagery, the similarities is he's trying to program a car that can adapt to new environments. And so the idea is you can drive your car anywhere. Within 10 seconds, you can have it learn the rules of the road in the place that it is, and like the different streets and everything, without actually having been there. And it's very similar to seeing whether or not we can adapt to new environments with motor imagery without actually ever physically doing the movement. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Even more off topic, I think that like neuroscience and computer science are going to be more and more intertwined as time goes on.
Yeah.
Since I could just be speaking completely out of turn here, but with like large language models and stuff, we're effectively making these programs that are trying to emulate human behavior. So it's super interesting.
It is. And
to not get too down that rabbit hole. But
I don't think a computer scientist would disagree with you. In fact, after having that conversation with my brother, I was like, maybe we should write a paper together. I know that there are some big differences in how our neural networks work in our brain versus how a computer neural network, you know, how it works. But the more we learn about the brain, the more we can advance computer science and vice versa. And you know what? I want to say that motor imagery research is very prevalent in the Bow Lab, but maybe there are some AI researchers out there that could be looking at the stuff we're doing.
That's true. I had a researcher once tell me that anytime they have, like, they see posts about conferences in their city, they'll just go, even if it's a totally unrelated topic, because they were like, a lot of times people are doing adjunct or similar things that you're doing, just in a totally different viewpoint.
Right.
Like, so it could be like bird research, but the way that they're going about the question, you're like, wait a second, that kind of is similar to the way I'm going about the question about, like, for example, like, adaptation of your environment, and it gives you new ideas. So there's definitely a lot to learn from various fields.
That's why interdisciplinary research is becoming so cool nowadays.
Hot topic.
And yeah, you know what, again, not to
so chic,
I think at this point I think at this point this story is now going to be on topic of our off topic conversation. But
a nice little segue.
But basically, like, when I was in my undergrad before starting my master's, my other like route of research that I was going to go down was in anthropology, which seems very unrelated to what I'm doing now. But my professor was studying ultramarathon runners as an anthropologist. And it's like, it wouldn't be the first thing that you think that an anthropologist does, right? And she's working with EMGs and IMUs and all these things I learned in kinesiology. And I just ended up being somebody who would be a very strong candidate despite my one anthropology course I'd taken in my undergrad, you know? So it's really cool, the overlaps between subjects and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I think it should be more encouraged in a university. And even outside of that, just research in general.
Yeah, only become friends with people. No, I'm just kidding.
Do not be friends within your own lab. Yeah. Venture out.
That would be terrible.
Sorry, I have enough neuroscience friends.
Yeah. My roster is full.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess to kind of end off this podcast, you did allude to when I asked you about your overall impact of your research, you said, oh, which research? The lab research? Do you want to expand on the other research that you do outside of the lab?
Sure. Outside the lab, I'm also a researcher at the IWK Health Center and the Department of Neonatal Medicine. I guess the Department of Pediatrics, really. But the field that I'm currently doing research in is in the neonatal realm. In particular, iron deficiency in preterm infants, where we're looking at... Okay, a couple of steps back. Basically, being born preterm, not great.
Yeah.
Being born preterm also puts you at a higher risk for iron deficiency. And there's a lot of research to show that having iron deficiency in infancy and childhood, if left uncorrected, can lead to disastrous permanent developmental consequences, from impaired cognition to minor learning difficulties in school to full-blown muscle, just a total derailing of normal development. So being able to identify iron deficiency and thus treat it quickly is super important. And it's even more important, not even more, it is also critically important in preterm infants as they're at this higher risk of getting it. So one of the problems with testing for iron deficiency in preterm infants is that the, I guess, most commonly used form is that of serum ferritin, or one of them, and it is affected and not as reliable of a measure in conditions of inflammation and or infection, which, if you can imagine, a preterm infant is already more pre-exposed to getting, one, inflamed, and two, infected. I guess there could be some arguments against that, but either way, it's important to have an alternative measure, reliable measure of detecting and screening for iron deficiency in these preterm infants that isn't serum ferritin. So that's the bulk of my research, is looking at another measure called reticulate hemoglobin equivalent, which has been around for a while, and there's a lot of mixed evidence to its use in the preterm infant population. The evidence is pretty overwhelming that it's a really good measure of iron deficiency in older pediatric populations and adult populations, but you can't extrapolate the data that you find in an adult or even a child to a preterm infant. Yeah. They're wildly different patient populations, so that is what we're currently looking at. And the applications of that research is a lot more... can be fast-tracked to being applied a lot easier, I suppose, where it could and would, if the findings are convincing enough, I suppose, be directly put into practice, because they have all the testing equipment right there, and it's basically just an analysis of this one particular study is just a bunch of aggregate data, but that's the stuff that does inform and update clinical guidelines pretty regularly. So it is really interesting work. And it's kind of what I do in the lab and what I do at the IWK are not related at all. But it is fun to bounce between both. I really do like it. It's
Imagine once you get bored of like going into the theoreticals, motor imagery, you're like, okay, application.
Yeah, go crunch some numbers. So
I think it would, I would honestly like just be super nice to sometimes turn off your brain for one thing and focus on the other.
Definitely.
And go back and forth. I secretly do that with the podcast, but don't tell Sean. Uh-oh. hoping someone will sponsor me one of these days.
Come on, Monster.
maybe like a cool sports company.
Gymshark?
Yeah, Gymshark. Sportiva climbing shoes. Oh, yeah. That'd be cool.
Maybe the company that makes those robots.
Oh, true. Yeah. Yeah, and then maybe I'll get a robot.
Boston Dynamics, come on. Help us out.
Yeah, let me know. Well, it was super cool chatting with you about your research and even about Hodson's hot takes. Did I say your name wrong?
You said Hodson's.
It's okay. It's an up for interpretation. You kind of
combined Hudson and Hot.
Hodson's hot takes.
Hodson's. I think I almost said Hodson's hot takes. That's not what I meant. Hodson's hot takes and going into the research that you do at the IWK and even just your journey to the LBRF lab. It was great to chat with you today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been fun and a pleasure to be here.
Up next,
yeah.
Flaming hot.
Flaming hot takes.
Viewer discretion advised.
Honor students aren't real people.
Well, thank you for listening to our podcast, Mind the Gap. I am your host, Juliet.
And I am your co-host, Teresa.
And this was recorded at CKDU.